This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The majority of living things live in the ocean. And we humans are making a mess out of it or changing it. And squids, being both predators and prey, because they're in the middle of the food pyramid, are they going to take over the world? This on? Hello?
We're all science people.
Science!
Exactly.
We know it's a good idea because it's lasted.
We can teach kids and they get it.
There's chemistry in here. There's biology in here.
It's in whiskey. It's in ice cream. It's in who you fall in love with.
That's the recipe for success.
We can make the world better for everybody.
Starting now.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Science Rules. I'm your host, Bill Nye. And this is the show where science rules. It's a call-in show. So if you want to be on the show, and I hope you do, please call in to the number 470-ASK-BILL. That's 470-275-2455. See what we did there? 470-ASK-BILL, where you ask Bill questions. So to find out when to call, check me out on the electric internet that the kids use. Once again, I am joined, of course, by science writer, editor, and dear friend, seriously, Corey S. Powell. Greetings, Corey.
Greetings, Bill. Seriously. So, you know, Bill, as you may know, I spend a lot of time, maybe a little too much time, on Twitter. And what I enjoy there is not so much the horrible knockdown, drag-out fights, but the cool videos.
I was just watching one
that seems to show an octopus dreaming. It was just so mysterious, and it really got me thinking about this all this world, all this life down in the deep ocean that we barely know about.
And of course, we depend on the ocean.
And we depend on the ocean. And I was thinking, there's so much more I want to know, and that seems like something that you and this show can help me with.
I believe you have once again, Corey, crystallized my thoughts, because today we are joined by biodiversity scientist at the American Museum of Natural History, AMNH, as we call it, Dr. Samantha Chang. Welcome to Science Rules, Dr. Chang.
Thank you.
You are a fan of the headfoots, the cephalopods.
I am a fan of the headfoots, yes. No torsos.
So tell us what a cephalopod is.
So a cephalopod is a group of animals. They are in a phylum called Mollusca. These include things... mollusks like clams and snails and sea slugs.
What about my old boss? Huh?
Try not to snort here.
Bill's going to be here all week, by the way.
So go ahead. Clams.
So clams and oysters and lots of the squishy stuff, a lot of things that have a hard external shell. And within this group, there is a class called cephalopoda. And cephalopod means head, foot, ceph, and pod, the two roots there. And these are your octopus, your cuttlefish, and your squid, as well as nautilus.
Oh, the nautilus is in the same group.
They are, yes.
Now, you said class. They're a class of animals, like insects are a class.
Yes.
Class insecta, so class mollusca.
Class cephalopoda and phylum mollusca.
And they're head foots because they're... heads are directly attached to their feet, and there's sort of no torso in between. Is that where the name comes from?
Exactly. They have many arms and tentacles, depending on whether they're an octopus, a cuttlefish, or a squid. And their head and all of their internal organs that are within that cavity are directly attached to those appendages.
But this is, once again, the land creature saying, where's your thorax, man?
Pretty much.
or woman, and they're maybe down there saying, what is with all that extra
thoracitivity? Right. You know, your mouse and your stomach are really close together there.
Yeah.
Okay, wait a second. So arm, leg, tentacle.
What's the difference?
Yeah, what is the difference? And how do you know, does an octopus have eight arms or eight legs or both, neither?
So an octopus has eight arms. The difference between an arm and a tentacle is that the arms have suckers all the way to the tip, and the tentacles just have them at the very end. And so your tentacles can be used for a lot of different things. So, you know, they can be used to bring prey in closer to the body where they're grabbed by the arms and then eaten. So you can think of, you know, cuttlefish, the way that they hunt is they hang out on the reef.
Tell us about cuttlefish. I think a lot of people don't even know what a cuttlefish is.
So a cuttlefish is closely related to things like our squids. But what's different between a cuttlefish and a squid is that they have this hard internal sort of shell called a cuttle bone. And so, you know, I used to say when we were out in the field and we were looking for squids to pick up at the fish market, that if you poke something that looks kind of like a squid, but it's hard, it's a cuttlefish. But if you poke it and it's really soft, you're a squid and it's good to collect.
So when we were doing the Science Guy show, it's very important to distinguish, like, what makes a fish. You got to have a backbone.
Mm-hmm.
So does a cuttlefish actually have a backbone?
No. So they don't have a backbone, but they do have that cuttle bone. And so that cuttle bone...
Is it a bone or cartilage?
So it's made of sort of like a chitinous material.
Like your fingernails?
Kind of like that. And so they're calcium-based. And what you find in squid are things like pens. And these are leftovers of that external shell.
Pens. That,
yes, a pen. Or sometimes called a sword.
a squid has a cartilaginous... sword.
Yep,
or pen.
In its body. And that sort of gives it a little bit of internal structure. And so ancient cephalopods had an external shell. So the nautiluses that exist in the oceans today, they're the last living cephalopod that has that external shell. And so over time, you know, between the Jurassic and the Cretaceous, during this big adaptive radiation of marine life, where lots and lots of marine species were coming into existence.
Radiation in this usage means spreading out.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a nuclear thing.
Not a nuclear radiation. People also call it the Marine Mesozoic Revolution. But this was a time where...
Exciting times.
It was very exciting, an evolutionary time, where we had a lot of new species coming about in the ocean. So new fishes, new predators.
So what... If I have a shell, I'm thinking I'm in good shape. I got a shell, I'm protected, but I got to lug the shell around.
Exactly. And so that was a trade-off that a lot of ancient cephalopods, we think, had to make. And so a lot of the ones that had that heavy external shell, and even ones that had heavy internal shells, weren't able to swim away as fast. And so the way that cephalopods move is by sucking water in to their body through the mantle and jetting it out through the funnel, so the sort of jet propulsion way of movement. And when you have that shell, it does limit how big your body can expand and how fast you can move. So for a lot of those, you know, they had experienced a lot of drag. They couldn't get away from predators as well. And some species started to evolve this squishier body with an internalized shell.
Not quite a skeleton.
Exactly.
So I do want to move on from cuttlefish. But is a cuttlefish not a fish?
A cuttlefish is not a fish.
A starfish should be a sea star.
A sea star, yes.
So should we pioneer the term sea cuttle?
Ooh, a sea cuttle. That's very...
Or we could just call them cuttles.
Yeah. I mean, they are a little cuddly. They are quite curious animals.
How do you know they're curious?
I have had many personal experiences.
I'm wondering, how do you know they're curious?
Having a good old cuddle with a cuttlefish.
I mean, you're swimming around. Are you scuba diving?
I did a lot of scuba diving.
And then a cuttlefish, a sea cuttle.
A sea cuttle, as we might call
them. Jets up
them.
To you, siphons up to you.
I think it was a slow siphon. So I was diving out in Indonesia, and my first experience with a cuttlefish.
How deep are we?
We were pretty shallow, probably about 20 feet mm-hmm, in the water. Yeah. So a lot of cuttlefish are quite shallow water species. Mm-hmm. And this particular one was just hanging on a coral there.
If you could see her, she's like, have you ever seen people describe what their dogs do?
Yep.
Yeah.
She has her little cuddle paws over her notes. She's
yep.
cuddling.
Yeah. So so how old were you at the time of your first cuttlefish experience?
Oof. I am going to guess I was probably 22.
So about the curious cuttle.
So this case curious,
of the curious cuttle.
In some ways, perhaps I was the curious cuttle. And I saw this cuttlefish sitting there, and I really was interested in slowly coming up to it to see what it was doing, what its behavior was like. And this cuttlefish just turned around and stared at me. And so then we're both sitting there staring at each other for a while. My dive buddies at that point were getting very irritated because I was sitting there staring at this cuttlefish. And then
have research to conduct.
Yep,
or
we
something.
Have things to do.
We're going
We've
through
got,
air.
You know, fish
and probably other cuttlefish are thinking, like, what's up with this cuttlefish? Why are you staring at this person for such a long time?
And so, you know, cephalopods communicate with their skin. They can change the color of their skin. They can change the texture of their skin. And many species also communicate with their arms and their tentacles. And so for cuttlefish, as well as some squid, different arm positions can signify different things. So when cuttlefish are hunting, they stick their arms out sort of into groups to the side like an airplane sort of, mm-hmm. and sort of speed around the water and sometimes run this striped pattern that rotates on their skin to mesmerize their prey. And so
wow.
we're sitting there.
It's like people with that disorder if there's a flashing light.
Mm-hmm, right? And so you see that you can imagine being a fish and swimming around and seeing this strobing light and being like, oh, goodness, I don't know what's happening. I've been eaten.
Yeah. I'm gonna stay real still to see what this thing is, and then he or she gets eaten. So there's the cuddle.
There's the cuddle.
There you
there's
are.
Me. There we are having this moment, and it starts to move its arms around in all sorts of patterns. And then I'm sitting there going, I can totally talk to this cuttlefish. We can communicate. So I started moving my arms around. And then
so
we kept
it's like
doing
you're doing
it.
Semaphore almost.
Yeah, a little bit of like little arms above the head and sideways. And so who knows what I was saying. I probably sold my firstborn child to this cuttlefish without knowing it. And, you know, we had a really interesting moment. And it was a really interesting sort of way to observe their behavior in the wild and see what they can do. And, you know, scientists who study cephalopod behavior have, you know, looked at them in captivity and just seen the different ways they sort of learn about the environment around them. They can change their skin to match any background. You know, people have put paintings of the Mona Lisa underneath an aquarium tank and watched as the skin has sort of changed to
so here's
not
the thing.
Pink texture, but the color.
It's not just cuttles, but the famous animals that are out that do this are the octopuses,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
How is this done? You guys have studied this, I take it. How
yeah.
do you get camouflage so perfectly if you are a cuttle or an octopus? Can squid do it?
Squid can. They don't change their skin texture as much as cuttlefish and octopus do. And part of this might be due to the different places where they live. So
and
there
swim
are,
they have wavy arms, swim fasters.
They are wavy arms and swimming fast, but they also live more out in the open ocean. And so you get a lot of large squid species that live in the deep ocean, that live out in the open ocean. And there are some that do live closer to shore, you know, closer to these, you know, very varied environments like a coral reef or a seagrass bed or you know, the pier.
And so they can change to match those different surroundings.
Yeah. And so what a lot of squid do is they can change sort of the way that their body reflects light. And so if you can imagine, you know, you're a squid and you're swimming around in the water and there's a predator underneath you. That predator underneath you has the advantage of being able to see your silhouette in the water. You
know, oh, looking up against
down,
the lit up surface of the ocean.
You can imagine, you know, all those movies with, you know, the sharks looking up and you can see the swimmer on their surfboard. And much of the same way, that's what happens to animals in the ocean as they're swimming sort of closer to the surface. But what they can do is something called countershading. And so they
countershading.
Mm-hmm. So some animals have that built in. That's their coloring. They have a lighter colored underside and a darker topside.
If you catch a fish,
mm-hmm.
observe fish. A lot mm-hmm. of times they're white, shiny on the bottom and dark, scaly on the top.
Or, mm-hmm. or penguins are like that.
Or penguins, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Maybe eventually humans also. But especially
wait,
if you're
wait,
particularly sunburned
are,
on the back.
Are you giving away something here about human evolution? This is an interesting turn we've taken.
So there you are. You're a squid.
So you're
swimming
a squid.
Not too far from the surface. Predator. Who's a predator for you?
Oof, lots of things. Larger fish.
Larger squid.
You know, depending on what part of the ocean you're in, you could seals and sea lions as well, whales.
Humans, of course.
Humans. And so a lot of the things that we know about what eats squid are by looking at the gut content of these predators. Mm-hmm. And so we've discovered that, you know, squid are actually really important in the food and the food web of marine ecosystems because they're a mid-level, what we call a mid-level trophic
So there's benthic. That's the bottom.
Right. So in this case, it's not necessarily about where you live in terms of depth in the ocean, but in terms of how many things you eat and how many things eat you.
You're in the middle of the pyramid.
And so they're right in the middle. And so you can imagine that, you know, if squid were to disappear, if a lot of cephalopods were to disappear, it will change how all these food webs are structured, because all of a sudden this core center disappears.
So let me ask you an unrelated but related question. Recently, I was in Maine, the country, the state of Maine, here in the U.S., and they were we met with somebody, the head of education at the Booth Bay Aquarium, and she was telling us that the lobster population has exploded or has gotten very, very large because humans have eaten all the fish that used to eat the lobster larvae. All right. My understanding is an octopus has thousands of eggs at a time. Is that right?
They can. Depending on the species, they can have thousands of eggs. Squid certainly also can have thousands
of
eggs.
So then everybody's eating the squid larvae. Is that right?
They are. So what's...
By everybody.
Everyone's doing it. They're eating both the larvae as well as the adults. Mm-hmm. And what's quite... So the way that squid live, sort of call it the live fast and die young and have lots and lots of eggs sort of lifestyle. And so they have really high rates of egg production.
Wait, so how long do they live?
Ooh, it varies. So the squid that I work on, they live in California, and they also live in a different species, a different group of species, lives in the Indian and Pacific and Mediterranean and Red Seas.
And really what do we call these squid?
Yeah, what is your squid of preference?
So my squids of preference are in a family of squids called Lolaginidae. They are nearshore squids. So they predominantly live along the coastal shelf. And they tend to live pretty short lives, anywhere from 6 months to a year. Mm-hmm. Really depends on temperature. So the way that squids mature is really tied to how warm the oceans are around them.
The warmer, the faster.
Warmer, the warmer, the faster.
All right. So then they're swimming along. Let's get back. The predator sees the squid.
Oh, yes. The predator sees the surface. And so what squid have, as well as other cephalopods, are these cells in their skin that not only can change color, but other ones that can reflect light. And so those cells can be activated to reflect that light back to get that similar counter shading kind of effect.
And so they do that to avoid getting eaten.
Stick around for more science rules after this.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price. People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Science Rules is back.
You know, one of the things that people have started to look at with cephalopods is the fact that their brains are dispersed throughout their body.
Yeah, the brain is not one place the way it is in some civilized animal.
Also some central brain in the head and then something more through the body? How does that work?
Yeah, so in some senses, they'd still have that central brain, but the way that their nervous system is distributed through their body, they're able to make those decisions on the fly. So, you know, for us, if we touch something that's cold, you know, that signal has to travel up back up to our brain where we decide, yes, that's something cold, and then send that signal back to your hand where you're like, I'm going to take my hand away because it's too cold. So for that, that processing is happening, you know, in those appendages, in those skin cells. And so there's, you know, a lot of research now that's trying to figure out, you know, how much are they aware of the surroundings around them.
The nature of cephalopodic consciousness.
Exactly. Which, you know, is both a scientific question, I think, as well as a philosophical one.
Well, here, I'll tell you. I mean, what's very striking to me, and I'm sure you've seen all these videos that make the rounds, you know, the octopus, you know, lying on top of a rock and it's completely invisible because every part of its body matches the color of the rock underneath
and
it.
The mm-hmm. texture.
And the texture.
They wrinkle up their skin in rock-like shape.
Unless mm-hmm. they have eyes or some sort of, you know, receptors on every single part of their body, how do they make the top of their body look the same as what's underneath them? To me, that's one of the most baffling
Dr.
things about
Chang,
them.
Yeah.
God, so much pressure. You know, and I think that is still one of the mysteries of cephalopods, and I think what makes them so interesting to understand. You know, one of the biggest areas that people have focused on for cephalopod research is in neuroscience, because of the way they're able to rapidly make, you know, adjustments to their skin texture and to their skin color based on, you know, whatever environment they're in.
With that said, speaking of more than one octopus, mm-hmm. octopuses, are they solitary or are they social?
They can be social. So squid in particular tend to school. And so many squid travel in a cohort of squid that are around the same age and maturity. And what's really interesting about squid is that they come together often in these big spawning aggregations.
Spawning.
Spawning.
So they come together to interact.
Yes, they do. And the way that squid—
Can we say interact, Corey? We can say interact. You're okay with that, Dr. Chang?
Yeah. I like to say spawn, personally.
Spawn.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it sounds a little more superhero.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
So they're spawning. There they are.
So they come together in these big groups, and, you know, the different, the males and the females, they engage in different types of courtship behaviors.
Tentacle waving?
It's actually a lot of skin flashing, which sounds a little more illicit than—
Yeah, I was going to say, this is racier than spawning. Skin flashing.
A little skin flashing.
So they use the adjustment of the skin color. This is also for sexual signaling.
Something like you might see at a drunk person at a certain event.
Nope.
Bill, please go on.
They're already naked, technically. So what's really interesting, though, is that the different individuals will flash different colors. So, for example, females will sort of change their skin so that they're more translucent. So you can see their organs and see that they're ready to mate. And some females that are ready to mate often will flash this sort of transparent, translucent mode as they're swimming around this aggregation. And the males will flash different colors. And oftentimes, they'll flash one color on one half of their body that's facing the female, and they'll flash an aggression display on the other side to other males.
How do I know it's how do you, scientist Dr. Chang, know it's an aggression display?
So what people have done to study behavior is they've put different individuals, males and females, into tanks at different sort of spawning readiness of different maturity and observe their behavior. And we're able to classify that based on what they were doing. So you observe enough different individuals in different settings over time, and you're able to start to class different behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to ask about the dreaming squid, or I guess it was a dreaming octopus. Mm-hmm. There's a video that shows an octopus asleep, apparently
what we would call asleep.
Appearing to be asleep, changing color as it's sleeping, and there was a scientist kind of interpreting that these color changes are almost as if it's dreaming. Is that legitimate? Is that for real?
I mean, it's certainly, I think, one of the first times it's been observed. So, you know, it's possible that, you know, there are, you know, neural processes happening as the octopus is at rest.
So is there any relationship between this octopus dreaming and our dreaming is a question I cannot help but wonder about.
It's also a question that I wonder about. And I think, you know, I think there's certainly a possibility that the types of memories that are stored in an octopus brain can perhaps be replayed depending on the right circumstances and context. What I don't know about that particular octopus is, you know, was it in a tank? Was it in a stressful situation? You know, what sort of situation and what types of factors created the sort of scenario where that was happening in its sleep? Was this a one-time thing? Was this something that happens often? And that's really the basis, I think, of a lot of the questions we ask in cephalopod biology is, you know, is this type of behavior that we're observing something that is common? Is this something that's stress-induced? Or, you know, is it something due to captivity or, you know, a certain situation they're in?
But your main deal is conservation.
My main deal is conservation.
And so here's the ocean full of the other two-thirds, as we say. And the majority of living things live in the ocean. And we humans are making a mess out of it or changing it. We're adding carbon dioxide, which creates carbonic acid and so on. And squids being, if I understand this, mid-level both eTORs and ETs,
mm-hmm.
both predators and prey, because they're in the middle of the food pyramid, are they a big concern? Or are they going to take over the world?
You know, I think there are a lot of folks out there, perhaps including myself, who are convinced that our cephalopod overlords are going to come and take over.
And why would they do that?
So cephalopods, I think, have sort of emerged in popular culture, as this mysterious species that we model our concepts of what aliens might look like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a science fiction movie, Life, that imagined life, you know, they discovered life on Mars, and basically it was an octopus.
Yeah, I think.
And the recent movie.
Arrival.
Arrival, yes. They had seven legs, seven
they did,
arms,
and they
seven
still
tentacles.
Communicated with ink.
Yeah. Well, sure you do.
Of course. But, you know, I think one of the things that in the beginning, when we're thinking about how the oceans might change over time with both.
When you say in the beginning, when was this?
Yeah, sort of, I think in the beginning of thinking about how cephalopods would respond to different environmental
conditions.
5 years
ago, 50 years ago?
I would say probably a few decades ago.
Like contemporary with The Sea Around Us by Rachel Carson and stuff like that?
So sort of in the time where our fisheries for finfish, as we called them, so our actual fish with vertebrae, started to decline, what we saw was that cephalopod populations were booming. And so not only were the populations seemingly remaining steady, but because there wasn't as much fish out there, people were starting to catch more cephalopods. So more cuttlefish, more octopus, more squid. But one of the things that's always been difficult for fisheries, for cephalopods, is figuring out how we actually manage them. So as you can imagine, the ocean is a big place. It's really hard to figure out where these are going, you know, how long they're living, how they respond to different types of disturbances. And for a lot of squid fisheries, they experience what we call a boom and bust cycle. And so you'll get these huge population booms where you have lots of squid to fish, and then another year they'll be gone. So for one species that I work on, the California market squid, you know, this is the most valuable fishery for the state of California.
This is where we get calamari.
Yes, that is where you get calamari. And for that fishery, you know, after folks were able to observe the pattern of when these populations boomed and when they busted and correlate them with different variables for ocean conditions, they saw that every time there was an El Nino event, so where the temperature of the ocean was drastically different before, it was a lot warmer, you get in the next year or two, the next fishing season or two, a big major crash in the fishery. And so that allows for a little bit more predictability of how to manage that fishery. But what we're seeing in these past few years, you know, I don't know if people remember, in 2014, 2016, there was something called the Pacific Blob. And there was this mass of really warm water out in the Pacific Ocean, and that was coming towards shore. And so what it did is it dramatically altered the temperature of these coastal habitats in California all the way up the West Coast.
How many degrees Celsius, degrees Fahrenheit are we talking about?
So it really depended on where you were in the blob. There are a couple degrees difference in some places where you didn't have as much water circulation. You had, I think it was up to 5 degrees difference.
And so it's like the warmer water just stays up top and doesn't get circulated around.
And then as it sits there, it tends to get warmer, deeper and deeper. And so after that, what we saw was that there are squid occurring in places far further north than they've ever been before.
And because it was warmer.
Because it was warmer. And so in places like Alaska, where they had seen these squid before, but never in such high abundance that there was actually enough to warrant a fishery for it. You know, in the past few years, there have been enough squid up there that they're actually thinking about, you know, is this something that we should be fishing because they're here?
Hmm. Now, Bill, you know what kind of a show this is that we're running here?
This is a call-in show.
You are correct, Bill. And you know what we have on the line?
I don't even have to guess. We have a caller.
We do have a caller.
Is his name Brendan?
Yes. Brendan, are you there?
Are you out there?
Yeah. Hi.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Orlando, Florida. And I was wondering, as far as cephalopods are concerned, what is like the whole, is there a... any kind of symbiosis or anything that we can look at as far as research for squid and octopuses that have an impact on coral reefs? Like, is there any way to introduce species or whatnot that would help to take care of predatory species on coral reefs that add to the calcification effect of, like, say, the Great Barrier Reef?
That is a fantastic question. And to be honest, I'm not sure if anyone has really thought about...
Do squid eat zooxanthellae or coral or whatever that can?
No, so they don't.
Do they live around reefs?
They do live around reefs. So the species that, or the group of species that I study called Sepiotuthis is, it's called the big fin reef squid. And they live in and around reefs. And so they actually, the reef habitat's really important for them because it's a place for them to lay their eggs. So they often lay them underneath coral, you know, those big plating coral that you see that look like a tabletop. They oftentimes lay their eggs underneath it because it's a bit safer. But they don't actually eat or damage the reef itself. If anything, it's a place for them to hunt. Similarly, you know, octopus species will create burrows in reef habitat, sort of hiding in between coral and different types of sort of hard substrate to hide themselves. But whether or not cephalopods could be considered as something that could help protect reefs, you know, I think one of the things we have to remember about coral reef ecosystems is that, you know, all of those organisms are connected to each other. And so by conserving one, you know, if we want to save one particular species, we're going to have to make sure that their habitat is also viable as well. And that's what a lot of fisheries management is trying to do, especially in areas that fringe tropical coral reefs, you know, in order to make sure that squid fishery is still around, for people to have jobs, for people to have food to eat, they're going to have to make sure that that coral reef environment is going to be protected.
There you go, Brendan.
Okay. And you're involved, Dr. Chang, in a number of different conservation programs. Are you involved in programs specifically aimed at protecting the reefs?
So I am. So one of the things that I do as a conservation scientist is try and figure out what those connections between different organisms, between them and the ecosystem, as well as between people.
In the food web, the food pyramid of the sea.
Exactly. Or as I think many of us like to call it, the social ecological system. And so thinking that people are just as integral and important a part of the natural world as, you know, any squid or fish or coral.
Brendan, thank you very much for your call. Thank you. You've started us down a fabulous road of conservation. Valerie, are you out there?
Yes, I'm here.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from San Francisco.
Out west someplace. So you have a question.
Yes, I wanted to call about sushi consumption. Is it bad for the ocean that I and other people are eating more and more sushi?
You know, what's really interesting about where our seafood comes from is that because now we have planes, you know, our world is much more connected, our food comes from everywhere. And one of the things that is really surprising that we found in our work on seafood is that the sushi we get sometimes isn't actually what we think it is.
My goodness.
Dun, dun, dun. I'll make my own sound effects. So
they issue it as crab, but it's really something
else. Meaning it's not really the fish that we think we're eating?
Right, exactly. So
what is it? Where is it coming from?
So there's two issues here. One is that the fish that you think you're eating, so say you order some yellowtail.
I've done that.
Yellowtail tuna.
Yellowtail as in hamachi.
Yeah.
Sushi. All right. And you think you're getting it. It's a great fish. And then we did some DNA barcoding. So we took a little bit of...
Wait, DNA barcoding. I think we need to decode that.
So, okay,
decode
let's break it down.
The barcoding.
Yes.
So like us, every living creature has DNA in it. And this is the genetic code by which we are built. And each one of us has a unique barcode that corresponds to us as an individual, us as a species. And so what we can do with seafood, especially sushi, because it's raw, is we can take a little bit of that sushi, we can extract their DNA, and run it through a database of all these different fish species and identify what species of that fish actually is.
It's like you're taking a genetic fingerprint to see, is this really the fish that
right.
they say it is?
Exactly. So doing a little bit of sleuthing there. And so, you know, myself, as well as a lot of different scientists around the world said, okay, let's look at the fish that we order in our restaurants. Are they actually what we think it is? And we discovered as, you know, for example, in the city of Los Angeles, where I worked, that half of the fish that we had ordered wasn't actually what we thought it was. And this isn't really an issue of, say, people trying to steal our money or trying to fraud us or trick us or sell us, you know, substandard fish for something else. A lot of times there's just confusion in you know, what fish we're even buying. So the way that our seafood gets to our plate is somebody fishes it. Oftentimes it's then sold to a larger distributor who sells that to an even larger distributor. You know, sometimes these are fished out at sea and that fish changes hands a lot of times. Sometimes it's processed, you know, you cut the fish up into fillets, it gets frozen, it gets into port, you know, it goes through another wholesaler, it goes to a market, and then it gets to a restaurant. And then it gets to you. So there's lots of opportunities there for things to get mixed up.
So should she eat sushi?
So should you eat sushi? Yes, you can still definitely eat sushi. But I would say the best thing for you to do, given what we know about the state of our marine resources, is to ask what your fish is and where it comes from. When you figure out what fish you're eating, I would do a little Googling and figure out, you know, what's the state of that fishery. There are great apps out there. Monterey Bay Aquarium has a Seafood Watch app where you can look up your fish and see, you know, whether or not it's endangered, whether or not, you know, it's a good choice alternative, if you should avoid it. And, you know, it's hard. It seems like a lot of information, right? I certainly feel a bit overwhelmed whenever I go to the seafood counter and the poor guy there is like, could you make up your mind already? But, you know, I think the more that people start to do that and the more people are aware that this is something that people find important, the easier it will be and the quicker we'll see change happen so that we're getting fish that are fished sustainably.
Science Rules will be right back.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You're listening to Science Rules.
Now, we also have Jordan. Jordan, are you on the line?
It's me.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. Oh, cool. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from the studio next door.
Oh, my God. Oh, the calls are coming from inside the house.
Yeah, I just have a question.
Are we going to use you on air?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yes. So we have Jordan calling from behind a plate of glass in this studio.
You know me. Hey. So I just have a question. I was home this summer and I went to the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And I was talking to someone who was working there and we were looking at an octopus in one of the tanks. And she was telling me that this octopus is very like, he was a really sneaky guy and he stole a lot of stuff from the employees that worked there. And
because he got bored, he's making unauthorized purchases on eBay.
He stole the stick, like the feeding stick that they use to put in the thing to feed all the other animal life in the tank. And then apparently the octopus put the stick behind his back as if they couldn't see it, the people working at the aquarium, and he was being sneaky and funny. So I was curious if this is like a quirk of generally all cephalopods or if it was unique to octopuses and if this can like tell us how smart they are.
That is a very hilarious story. And it's also not the first time I think I've heard about octopus antics from various aquaria. Also at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, behind the scenes, there is AstroTurf across all the tops of the tanks around where the octopus lives because it likes to leave its tank and go on little field trips to other tanks. And this has happened actually at a number of different aquariums.
So the octopus can live out of water for quite a few minutes.
They can actually move out of the water for a little bit of time. And so what, you know, different folks who work in aquarium have experienced is octopus that, you know, mosey out of their tank, go into someone else's tank, move stuff around, eats other tank inhabitants, so the mystery of disappearing fish was solved, I think, with some strategically placed motion sensor cameras.
Mm-hmm.
And actually at the Santa Monica Pier Aquarium, if I remember correctly, they got flooded once, and not because a tank broke, but because one of the intake or output valves got turned on so that seawater from the tank just flooded into the aquarium.
Turned on by an octopus.
And when they looked at the security footage, it had crawled out, turned it on, and crawled back into its tank afterwards.
We don't know what motivated it, but probably he's trying to look for an ocean,
the ocean. Or they're total assholes. Either one.
Shocking. Oh, my goodness. Corey, what could it be?
You know, even deep under the ocean, you can hear that sound. That's the sound. That's the thunder that comes from lightning, which tells me it's time for a lightning round with our guest here, Dr. Samantha Chang.
So, Dr. Chang, so we ask you a question, you give us that quick answer, as if struck by lightning.
Okay.
Gently.
Oh. Okay. All right.
So, Dr. Chang, if you were an octopus, what kind would you like to be, and where would you like to live?
I would like to be a blue ring octopus because I would be tiny but venomous. And I would live in the tropical oceans.
Where it's comfy. But you'd be venomous. You'd be, like, mean.
Yeah.
How venomous would you be?
So venomous.
Really venomous. Like, chop off your hand venomous. Otherwise, it'll travel to your heart and you'll die.
Wow. So if you get bitten by a blue ring octopus, take
just,
immediate
Just chop
steps.
Off your hand
yep.
immediately?
Yep. Right.
That's if you get bitten on the hand. Yep.
That's pretty badass.
Yep. That is badass. And so what do they do with that venom?
So what do the octopuses do?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They use it to hunt for prey.
They eat a fish. They grab a fish, sting it. Then the fish.
And they also use it to defend themselves.
Okay. So that could be you.
I guess so,
That could be you.
A badass cephalopod scientist, like a blue ring octopus.
Just try me.
Yeah. Yes. All right. What's your favorite? What's the best octopus camouflage?
Ooh, changing the texture of your skin.
That is pretty bad. That is also striking.
I can get goosebumps, and that's as far as I can go.
Right. Can you imagine how great it would be, how much money you would make if you're like, I can smooth out all those wrinkles by myself.
Wow. With just your mind or just your central nervous system distributed through your tentacles,
I don't think you would.
Arms,
you're not even actively thinking about it, to be honest.
Just get it done. Now, I like this term cuttlefish, but I much prefer sea cuttle. So I'm putting it out there right now because they're not fish.
I mean, we can bring it up at our next meeting.
Yep.
See, how do we feel about sea cuddle?
I'm putting in a plug for cuddle, which it changes the T's to D's. Make it a
cuddle. It's a cuddle.
Yep. But I think it's from, seriously, you guys, I did do a little etymological research. I think it has to do with carrying ink. It's a sack for ink. And so the cuddle fish, sea cuttle, has an ink sack, as do squids and other cephalopod buddies. Mm-hmm. Now, what's one thing you wish people knew about cephalopods?
Ooh. Cephalopods, I think the coolest thing about cephalopods is how often they show up in our myths. And so, you know, we kind of think about them as these aliens. They show up in movies. I'm a big alien movie fan. So I love it every time I see a movie and they look just like some kind of cephalopod. But what's I think is the coolest thing about them is that people have been observing these creatures, you know, for millennia. You look at the ancient Greek mythology, and there's the legend of a strait where there are two monsters on either side of it. And one of them is Scylla, and it's a woman with what occasionally is, you know, dogs or multiple dogs around her waist or these sort of mouthed creatures. And
she is badass in this case.
She is. And the other side is a whirlpool. And so sailors going through are sort of trapped between these two monsters. And when you look at the different depictions and the descriptions of Skyla, they all sound a lot like a squid. Mm-hmm. And I just I love all these different
multiple
ways.
Tentacles.
Multiple
arms.
Tentacles, arms with, you know, mouths
suckers.
On the end,
yes,
suckers.
Yes.
And so, you know, I think a squid and octopus have integrated themselves into our lives in all these different ways that we did more than just, you know,
because
calamari.
They're mysterious.
They are
come
mysterious.
And go. Like these animals can fit through tiny openings because they have so little hard material inside.
And as we heard before, they steal things.
They're whimsical.
They are.
What is the one thing about cephalopods you don't know, but you wish you did?
I would really like to know, are there different other ways of cephalopod communication besides with their skin? You know, what do they do when they go offshore? That's a mystery.
I mean, farther, deeper into
farther
the sea.
And deeper. And so these squid that I work on in California and the ones I also work on in Southeast Asia, there are a lot of times that they are not in these shallow areas where they're being fished.
And you can't tag them. You can't
follow
them.
And they're really hard to tag. They tend to pick their tags off, which, you know, you can imagine if someone put a tag on you, you're like, I don't want this. Mm. And
plus, I'm very dexterous with my eight arms.
Exactly. You know, you have no bones, so you can pick up something that's, you know, on your back.
Do you eat cephalopods?
So I will eat squid. There was a time I did not eat much squid, mostly because the samples that I collected for my research, you know, I bought them from the fish market, and rather than let them go to waste after we'd taken our samples, sort of looked at their organs and whatnot, so we would eat them. Mm-hmm. So there was, I think, one summer, my field team and I ate probably upwards of 80 kilograms of squid. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
You're fine now.
I'm fine. We went through a period where I couldn't smell them. I couldn't eat them. It was too much. But, you know, now I do eat cephalopods, but, you know, much like all seafood, I really try and check where it comes from. And if it's a fishery I'm familiar with, if it's from an area I know is well managed.
So what's next for you, Dr. Chang?
Like in general?
Yeah, well, like in your research.
like today.
Well, we're hoping you're going to continue to live for a while. But, like, what's next in your research?
So what's next in my research, at least for cephalopods, is I'm planning on doing a bit more field work and trying to explore other ecosystems that these squid that I work on live. And so I'd mentioned before that they live in the Indian, the Pacific, the Red Sea, and the Mediterranean. But, you know, the thing is, despite the fact that they have such a huge range, we don't actually know that much about them. We don't know that much about their biology. We don't even know how many species exist. The other part of what, you know, I'd like to do with understanding squid, and I mentioned this before with, you know, the fact that squid and cephalopods are so sort of a part of our human culture, is learning from people about, you know, what they know about the squid that are around them. And so some of the most insightful things that I've learned about squid are actually from fishermen working out in Indonesia. you know, trying to figure out what habitats they were living in. And you can imagine if I go out on my own to a place that I've never really been before, I'm relying on my sort of biological and ecological knowledge to think about, okay, what habitats might they live in? What they might be doing? And I'm just sort of out there exploring. But by working with people who live there, you know, have lived in places for generations, been fishing these squid for generations, they know a lot more than I do. And so I was able to learn in some parts of Indonesia, you know, these squid only live in certain coves. There's places that they frequent more often than others. They tend to avoid areas of fast water, which is actually one of the hypotheses we have about one of the species that I work on, that they avoid these fast water currents. And so they tend to have more localized populations. So each, you know, place that they live, that's an individual population. So those squid are more likely to hang out with other squid there, mate with other squid there, than they would be, say, across a big channel.
And their diversity would be more limited or recognizable.
Right.
This is just cool. Thank you so much, Dr. Samantha Chang, for coming to Science Rules today. We learned a lot about the ocean and our place.
And cephalopods. And I love cephalopods.
I loved cephalopods
them before, and now I love them more.
So thank you so much for coming.
Thank you both. This has been fantastic.
I'm Bill Nye.
I am Corey S. Powell.
And remember, when it comes to the cephalopodal, or watery sea creatural, part of our universe,
science rules.
If you like Science Rules, please take a moment to rate and review it in Apple Podcasts and on Stitcher. It helps us out. It helps other people learn about the show so they can listen and turn it up loud. Thank you. Be sure to look on my socials, as the kids say, for when to call into the show. I'm at Bill Nye on everything. I'm on the booking of the face, the Twittering, the gram, all that. Meanwhile, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, some of you may remember this technology.
Voicemail.
Yes.
Wow.
Give us a call at 201-472-0785, 201-472-0785, and we will absorb your thoughts as best we can. Science Rules is produced by Jordan Bell and Corey S. Powell.
Hey.
Both appeared on the show today, perhaps, if Jordan leaves herself in when she edits. With extra production from Lisa Wang, who screens your calls. Our engineer today is Casey Halford, the same Casey Halford who mixed this episode and composed our original theme song. Special thanks to Claire Rawlinson and Ashley Warren. Daisy Rosario is our executive producer. Chris Bannon is the chief content officer here at Stitcher. And at Stitcher, Corey,
what happens?
Science rules.
Yes.
Stitcher.